Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today we are reversing roles. Gareth Owen, OBE, Humanitarian Director of Save the Children UK, will be leading the conversation with me in a guest role. The Eco-Leadership Institute has just partnered with the Humanitarian Leadership Academy with the intention to deliver radical change in the humanitarian sector. This podcast was recorded in Save the Children office for their staff during a workshop, and we hope you enjoy it. It's an exploration of the journey so far.
Let's just get going, I think. Okay, well, thanks very much for those of you who've joined today. We're really happy to be here to kind of go on a bit of a journey, I think, Simon, is what we said we'd do, isn't it? Just describing how we got to this place of partnership between us. And the partnership is between, say, the Children, the Humanitarian Leadership Academy, and the Eco-Leadership Institute, which Simon is director of. I'll talk more about you in a sec, Simon, and then you get to talk about yourself. But firstly, we wanted to have this conversation because we're aware that this will be new to most of the people who are either joining us this afternoon or are going to listen back. But what we are aiming to do with this partnership over the next few years is to transform humanitarian thinking, and in particular, humanitarian leadership, by promoting and teaching and sharing and showing eco-leadership. And you'll start to become more familiar with these terminology as we go, and Simon's going to explain it to us today, I'm sure. But I thought I'd just frame the story a little bit, starting with the big picture. And the big picture is something that I think we're all rather familiar with these days, which is that we are in a time of great crisis, and humanity indeed faces lots of critical moments. Simon, you've described this as an entanglement of technological, social and environmental factors that are continuously disrupting the world that we live in.
Yeah.
The four C's, as we are all familiar with internally, climate, conflict, COVID, and indeed the cost of living, are a big part of that. And the sort of result of all this is a kind of violent and uncertain world for ourselves, for the children we help. And it seems plagued with fear and anxiety and uncertainty. But times of crisis are also, and history shows this, times of opportunity and avenues for exploration of an experimentation with new ideas and new ways of being. So that is the sort of, that's the times we're in. Closer to home, the aid ecosystem is experiencing a period of major transition. There's a loud corpus of critique out there that we've all engaged with over the last few years, which demands significant shifting of power, which is the language that we're all familiar with, away from the north. And the sincerity amongst leadership, especially in the INGO world, towards that, I think, is not in question. It's not the sincerity of desire to change, it's the how to do change seems to be the question that everyone's contending themselves with. And we've definitely experienced that acutely here in the UK. Really, since the 2018 scandal onwards, I think we've been perpetually in crisis as a sector, as an organisation. That was followed by, obviously, the loss of DFID, the COVID pandemic, the cost of living crisis. So this kind of crisis in a global sense, crisis in a more, you know, closer to home sense is everywhere. And the sort of period of massive expansion of humanitarianism that we all took part in, certainly people like me over the last two decades, really, here at Save the Children, has kind of come to an end, I think. Or we're seeing this kind of transitionary period. And we've also moved to a very different and quite radical stance, strategic stance, here as Save the Children UK in the humanitarian space. And, you know, we've created one humanitarian team as a major shift, a letting go of operationality, a letting go of power, if you like, internally at least. And that's been a huge shift. And for people to put that into perspective, at its peak in 2016, the humanitarian department had more than 300 staff. We're far less than that now, we're less than a third of that. And the vast majority of those who are left here, as it were, housed in SCUK, are working within the Humanitarian Leadership Academy And their role is very different. It's by definition operating from the periphery in support of locally led humanitarian action. So it's an act of power shift by its very existence. So the summation that we're working with, and you're helping us with, Simon, I'm going to come to you in a second here when I introduce you, is a kind of new theory of change for this changing world, which we say kind of the summation would be shifting the power demands new thinking and a different leadership mindset. And indeed, I would say a more soulful way of being that brings more humanity back into our actions. So I've no doubt that today's conversation will touch on many of those aspects, Simon, yeah, as we proceed. And indeed, we're planning a series of conversations for those who are interested on some of the kind of key ideas that are wrapped up in that little summary. For example, exploring more deeply, what do we mean by power and the shifting of it? You know, what do we mean by power? By the way, if others are in the building, you're very welcome to join us in the boardroom. If you happen to be here, but online's fine as well. So there are a few of us in the boardroom. So, okay, so let me just come to our guest, Dr. Simon Weston, the director of the Eco Leadership Institute, a renowned author of books on coaching and leadership, a podcaster, formerly director of coaching at Lancaster University, mm-hmm, a background in psychoanalysis with the Tavistock Institute. I've lifted all this off your own website, Simon. It might sound familiar to you. And your interests are wide-ranging. Leadership it speaks for itself. You're interested in that. Organisational culture, architecture, environmentalism, religious studies, politics and social sciences. And you have an academic and a practitioner history. And you take a critical and ethical perspective to what you do. And you work in good faith to build a good society. So that's who you are, according to your own website, Simon. And we first encountered each other in the flesh, as it were, quite recently in the last few months. I took part in your flagship course on analytical network coaching, which is fantastic. But many of us in the humanitarian leadership space encountered you first in written form, mm-hmm, when we took part in coaching, professional coaching qualifications, where your critical texts on leadership and coaching were course material. And my own reading of that back in 2018, 2019, there was something in that that said, this person gets it. This person gets the humanitarian world. This person is talking from a values base, from an ecosystemic perspective. And straight away, that connected a lot of us to you before we knew you. And then kudos to Sam Davis and the HLA team for reaching out and saying, well, you know, we're Save the Children. Let's talk to Simon directly and see if he's interested in working with us. And so here we are, and we've gone on a journey. So why don't we start there, Simon, with how did you end up here with us? You have a thing that you do, which is about who authored the author, which you got us all to do on your course. So I think people would be interested to know a bit about you to start with.
Thanks, Gareth. Yeah, and hello, everybody. I do something called, before, at the beginning of every book and the beginning of every course, I talk about how we locate ourselves, the need to locate ourselves. If I'm coaching a leader, I get them to locate themselves, because my assumption is that unless you can locate yourself, unless you kind of know where you came from and know what informs your thinking, it becomes a bit detached and there's a big dissonance there. So most of my work comes from personal experience. All of our work comes from personal experience. We can't write anything, do anything without drawing on our personal, on our social and our cultural backgrounds. So I think it's worth paying attention to kind of where each of us comes from. And my own journey has been an interesting one. I was born in Bristol in England. I went to an all-boys school, which was didn't offer much education. I got thrown out of school at 16. And I found myself working in a factory, a paper bag making factory in Hartcliffe in Bristol. And it was a formative experience, from being a naughty lad at school to suddenly being in the harsh nature of factory with machines running like 24/7, the noise I will never forget, and just that whole environment of, you came to work not to kind of think about anything. You didn't come to bring your passion to work. You came to bring your body to work. It was manual labor, and that was it. And the only time you got enjoyment was kind of when you left the machines, you clocked out and you went to the pub or the allotment or played rugby or did whatever you did. So it was a very harsh environment, but a good learning place. And I left the factory
Just before my 18th birthday, I did a couple of O-levels at evening class so that I could become a nurse. A friend of mine at a rugby club said, you should become a nurse, Simon. And it was a strange thing to say to a man because nursing was a very female profession. But he said, no, I can see that you're good. You work with the young rugby players. You're good with people. And I was thinking, anything to get out of the factory, let's try this thing called nursing, you know. And so I went, I applied. They were looking for male nurses, and I became a general nurse. And general nursing really informs how you understand the body. Like in a lot of jobs, we forget about the body. The body becomes very secondary. As a nurse, you work really closely with the body. You work with the living body, with the dying body. You see, you know, I saw young people coming in on the emergency room from a motorcycle accident my own age, just dying in front of me. It's a very powerful experience. I think as a nurse, you really get to understand what the body does for us, how resilient it is, how fragile it is, everything. I observed brain surgery, I observed legs being sawn off. It's kind of it's a world where the body is fundamental. But in general nursing, I was getting told off quite a lot for talking to patients because my thing was always kind of the psychological, the caring for people. I if someone was dying, I'd sit by the bedside, I'd talk to relatives, and it'd be Nurse Weston, go and clean the bedpans, don't talk to the patients. So you got this detachment where it's about the body, but you weren't supposed to get close to patients. You weren't supposed to empathise too much, because you get too close. So there is a bit of a strange environment. So I left general nursing and I went to psychiatric nursing. And I worked in one of the old-fashioned mental asylums in the north of England, up in Yorkshire. And it was a Victorian building on the edge of a town where the mad people were sent. Most cities had them. And it was quite a scary place. It had high walls, big gardens, and it had wards of 70 beds in a row. And you really learned in psychiatric nursing, you learned about total institutionalisation, how organisations can really institutionalise you. And it wasn't just the patients who were institutionalised, it was the staff as well. And I realised if I stayed there too long, you either became like them or you left, you know, you got thrown out or you left. In the psychiatric hospital as well, you also learn very much about sanity and madness and the thin line between the two. And at different stages in history and in different cultures, that line moves. So I met women who'd been in the hospital for 30 years because they had postnatal depression in the 1950s. And they never escaped, you know, it was dreadful. So you learn about the fragility of these lines in the sand about who's mad and who's well, and that's actually a very blurred line. And someone else often decides for you. So it was really deep learning experience. And this idea of total institutions, how institutions really impact on people, stayed with me. I mean, I worked in a bank recently, a couple of years ago, and I was asked by a group of senior managers in the bank. They asked me what I could teach them from my background in the public sector. And I said to them, you're all wearing black suits, you have open plan offices with 300 people in these places, and it seems to me you have a very conformist way of thinking. It reminds me of the psychiatric hospital. I didn't get asked back, but it was a lesson they took. And it was you do get, like in corporate life, you do get very conformist cultures. You know, you get super bright people, they can speak many languages, they can be expert in technology, and yet there's a very conformist expectation. And if you move outside those conformist boundaries, you get crushed or you get kind of demoted. So this idea of institutionalization was very, very powerful. I left the psychiatric hospital, I worked with young people, and I trained as a family therapist. And that was interesting because working with the body as a nurse, working with the mind in psychiatric nursing, as a family therapist, you work with the family system. And you realise that working with an individual child, you can't just understand the psychological illness or the emotional problem the child has without understanding what's going on in the family. A good example is a young man I worked with who was a school refuser, and he'd had CBT therapy, he'd had medication, he was labelled a school phobic, And we got his family in, and after working with his family, we building up some trust, we found out that he was staying away from school to protect his mother, who was getting abused by the father. It's a very good lesson to kind of remember, because we always question now, kind of never take the first diagnosis. Always think about kind of what that person, what that problem might say about the wider system. So that took me on a kind of systemic journey. And even wider, I started to realize that you couldn't really help this young person unless you worked with the social services, with the education, with the police, with these other systems around them, so that you kind of had a shared message. And we did some interesting pioneering work in Liverpool at that time. From there, I got a bit burnt out, and I decided to reflect on leadership. I was very interested in kind of why some of the hospitals, why some of the health sector I worked in, you had great people, a bit like the humanitarian sector, really great value-driven people, and yet the system seemed to kind of work against them. The bureaucracies, the management structures seemed to kind of inhibit our work with patients, not help us. And that really was painful, and it made me really want to study organisations and get a better understanding. So I went to the Tavistock Clinic, and I studied a master's in psychoanalysis and organisations. And I was very interested. The management studies I'd looked at, kind of the rational ideas, we understood what rationally should happen. We know what should happen in organisations. The question is why it doesn't happen. And that, I think, you have to understand the unconscious, kind of our emotional attachments to things, our unconscious resistance to change, our fear about change. So I studied that and got very, very interested in leadership. I did the master's, and then I went to Lancaster University to do a PhD in leadership. I partnered up with a professor, Jonathan Gosling. We worked together in a strategic leaders unit, and we had 10 years of working in executive education with leaders all over the world. It was really creative work, innovative work, and I was transferring skills from family therapy into the boardroom. It was kind of really interesting, and they appointed me as director of coaching at Lancaster. And I did a PhD in leadership, and that's where I kind of wrote my first book, the one you ended up reading three editions later. So I tell this story because the journey, if you think about it, I started in the factory, and as a nurse, that works with the body. I move into the kind of psychiatric world, and that's about the mind. I then work in family therapy, which is about working with a small group, the team, the system. And then I work as a consultant and a coach and in academia with the wider system, thinking about kind of social change, thinking about all the things which impact on us. So that's the kind of journey which informs my work now on eco-leadership.
And so when you were approached by us, what was it that sparked your interest? I mean, you work globally, you work with all manner of different organisations. What was it that sparked your interest in, say, the children, the humanitarian ecosystem?
Well, all my work is values-based, it's all ethical-based, that's where my heart, that's where my soul is. And when I work in corporate banks, I work in some of the big tech companies, I work all over the world. And I work there for two reasons. One, because it's important to work there. It's important that they actually think about ethics as well, think about the environment as well, think about leading differently. So you do some important work. But the secondary benefit for me is to try and understand how organisations work. I'm like an anthropologist. I love it. I go to car manufacturers and I see production lines. I go to banks and I see how banks work. And I learn. And I see myself as a kind of a bee cross-fertilising ideas from places. When I got the invitation to think about working with Save the Children, it's my family. And everyone said, like, this is for you, Simon. It's got you written all over it. You know, go for it. And it's, my passion is to work with people, or always has been about people, and it just fits really well.
So kudos to Sam and the HLA for reaching out to you, and it doesn't surprise me at all, having run your work, that there would be an affinity. So we then sent you off for 6 months on an exercise in diagnostics, and for those who are interested, the report of that I dropped into the start of the chat, so you can go to the link on the HLA website. There's a summary there, and then if those want to read the full 90-page report, go ahead. My advice to you would be, do carve out the time to read the whole report. It makes an awful lot more sense if you read the whole thing, though it does take time, and we recognise that's a challenge for everyone. So we sent you off to do 6 months of diagnostics, hoping to find out something different, knowing that your background was what it was, knowing that you weren't somebody, you'd done some work with the aid sector, the UN and the Red Cross in the past, but you were essentially a fresh pair of eyes on us, was how, and we wanted that ecosystemic kind of perspective from somebody who had the expertise in that. And you came back with what I consider to be actually a very seminal report, having read it. But the language is very different. The language it contains is very different. And it's fascinating to hear from those online, and if they want to drop questions in the chat, go ahead. But you had some key findings for us, Simon. The things that really stuck out for me were notions of sort of precarious interdependence. That's how you described the world we're in. The attachment to the ideology of modernity, which for those who are less familiar with that kind of language is this sort of this rationalization, the control, the hierarchy, the bureaucracy, the centralization, the paternalism, the instrumentalization, the audit and target culture, the neocolonialism, and so on. All the things, actually, where there is a very loud critique that out there that we've all been contending with over the last few years. You diagnose all that as a function of modernity, which is really interesting because actually we tend to see it as aid problems, but actually it's much wider than that. They're societal. And then you realise there was a stuckness in this story, a kind of binary thinking around localization versus centralization, global north versus global south, these kind of binaries. And you talked about entrapment and you talked about disenchantment, which I thought was very, very telling use of language. And it painted, for me, quite a familiar story. And I suspect for many who've read that, though the language might have been different that you're using, the story felt very familiar. And I would track that in my own experience, and I've written about this, as the rise of the humanitarian corporation. There's a chapter in the Midst of Debris on that, a podcast of Humanitarian, which people can listen to. So I was very struck with this idea of disenchantment that you centred on, which seemed like a psychoanalytic perspective. So could you say more about this? I mean, we might describe it in other terms as the sort of lost soul side of things.
Yeah, yeah.
Could you just sort of explain more about that and maybe how it then links with your work on eco-leadership, which is what we're going to try and... which we diagnose as a solution to some of this as we go forward.
Yeah, and the I mean, what I was interested in was there's a... you can read the critique of the sector. You know, the sector's done amazing things. I say that first. No, it just... It is an amazing sector. It does amazing things. That's important to note. And there's a critique of it, and the critique is, you know, decolonization process, too centralised, works like a machine, people on the edge can't get funding, too many regulations. There's all these kind of instrumental problems, and kind of familiar to me from the health sector as well. And yet the stuckness is people, rather than try and think differently about kind of how they can solve these, they get entrapped in a circle. And it's like, we must be more efficient, or we must get more growth. And they use this modernity language, is this idea of growth, of progress, of efficiency, of rationality, of cutting waste, and it goes round and round in circles. And that's where I think the stuckness is. So I wasn't diagnosing any new problems. You're very familiar with the problems. What I was trying to say was we had to find a different way out of this. And part of the problem is we're trapped in this way of thinking. We're trapped in numbers, we're trapped in metrics, we're trapped in data. It's not to say data's bad, but when you can't think beyond that, you're in trouble.
And there's something that strikes me in this around immunity to change as well. The idea that institutions build up quite strong immune systems that reject the radical.
Yeah.
Whether that, and for lots of very good reasons. You know, we have to be highly accountable as a sector, and that's built up in the 21st century, the ideas that have been written about as the sort of, as far back as people like Professor Michael Power at the LSE wrote a paper describing the new coloniality was internal control and risk management. And he wrote that paper in 2004. So it's not like it's got any easier in the sort of 20 years since. In fact, it's got a lot stronger. So there was a lot of, there's a lot in this that I think is familiar to people. Is that critique... is it widely known? I mean, these issues around modernity are out there, but you have to sort of go looking for that critique and you have to sort of connect with it. And it's a political discourse, it's a critical theory discourse, as well as, you know... Because often for aid workers, we sort of think the problems are all ours, and, you know, but we exist in the zeitgeist, we're products of society.
Right? It is a product of the zeitgeist. I mean, it's like if you look at the big politics, you can just look at climate change, and it's like everyone knows what the problem is, everyone knows kind of how we should be solving it, and yet... We withdraw from it. We can't work collaboratively. We don't get the partnerships we need. we turn a blind eye to it. There's an unconscious process in this as well, where it's not people are bad people or they don't want to make change. There's an unconscious defense against the anxiety of change, and people kind of get trapped really in mindset. So this modernist mindset is a real trap. It's like, you know, and if you do a language study, if you study the language of humanitarianism, it's interesting. You read some of these reports and they state these problems the same we've just shared, and then they say the answer is more efficiency, more, they use exactly the same language, and they go round it in a circle. So there's something about kind of stepping out of that and asking what else. How can we re-enchant the sector is my question, because you'll get no change unless you can re-enchant the sector. And to re-enchant, you have to kind of move outside this instrumentalism, outside this numbers game. And again, it's not to say numbers are bad, it's that there's numbers are useful, and we need to be re-enchanted, and we need to collaborate, and we need to work more mutually together. And we need to think more ecosystemically, because at the moment we're just thinking in boxes.
So if you take a sector like banking, which you've worked in,
yeah,
how do they, when you start, and you should explain perhaps a bit about eco-leadership and eco-mutualism, this idea, but when you go into a bank, which is all about numbers, how do they sort of hook on to what you're saying? How does it play out?
Well, what's interesting is in the banking sector, in the health sector, in the retail sector, in all the sectors I work in, they all face very similar problems. They play out differently, but the problems are similar. So in the banking sector, there was a financial crash. You had all the best experts in the world crunching numbers, but they were in a linear line. They weren't looking holistically. People who critique the system, that people, some people knew it was going to fail, but they were thrown out. They were discarded. So the maverick voices were discarded, and everyone kind of kept going. The financial sector is very worried about fintech, about kind of technology knocking out all the banks. They realise now they're in an ecosystem. They can't just kind of be banks making money anymore, like, and just keep on putting up interest rates or whatever. They know that kind of this ecosystem is fragile, and it depends on emotions, it depends on political climate, it depends on so many different things. So now they bring me in because they understand they have to start thinking ecosystemically.
And, you know, I mean, two old white dudes talking about this stuff. How does it play culturally? What's the sort of intercultural kind of, intergenerational kind of, how has that played through for you?
It's the biggest generational divide I've come across in the last sort of 10 or 15 years. I every workplace I go to, people are saying, like, this new generation are thinking differently. Not better or worse, but differently. You know, so they do think in a more network way, in a more ecosystemic way. At some levels, the attitude to work is different, the expectations are different. So that there is a generational challenge. And internationally, I mean, we live in a global world, so global forces kind of play out. You see a lot of the similar things, but everywhere you go is local and specific. I never try and generalize kind of whole patterns. I wrote a book on global leadership patterns,
yeah,
and that was very, very interesting to get people from all different regions writing about their history, their culture, and how leadership showed up in these cultures. There was universal kind of similarities we could share, and there was real differences as well.
So could you say a bit more about how you sort of, because you, the thing that's very interesting in your book, that is these different eras of leadership that you describe,
yeah,
which are part of this process of modernization throughout the 21st century. It would be good if you said a little bit about that, and then how you end up at eco-leadership, but also then eco-mutualism, and when you've gone out into Poland and into Zimbabwe as part of your diagnostic.
Yeah.
You said that people very quickly were on your wavelength with this. So yeah, That's interesting as well. It'd be interesting to hear more from you about that.
That was really interesting. So we'll come back to that. But, I mean, I did a PhD, and that's like you have to read a lot of books and a lot of papers to do a PhD. So it's sort of 4 years' work, and I was working full-time, and I was staying up to 2-3 in the morning reading every kind of... My PhD supervisor said, Simon, don't write anything for a year, just read leadership. And it was great advice, because I just lost myself in reading. And as I read, I was trying to... I had post-it notes everywhere around my room, and I was trying to kind of organise my thinking. And I realised that there was four major discourses, four major approaches which came through on leadership over the last 100 years. And the first was controller leadership. And this was kind of leadership in the factory, leadership where you had science for the first time was applied to the workplace. So you had Taylorism, you had the Ford factory, and the idea was, like, use science to make the workplace as efficient as possible and use rationality to kind of do that. So they had time and motion studies. You clocked in, you clocked out. They broke down and let the work into component parts. So you just did, rather than make a chair, you made one part of the chair and you did it as fast as you could. And you got the production lines. And that was all about controlling resources, controlling people. And that mentality is still with us today.
Line management.
So it's all about applying science, applying rationality and controlling the environment. And to be fair, like, massive changes took place because of that. You know, we got mass production, which meant mass consumption. It improved kind of healthcare, improved many things. You know, so we shouldn't just knock it and say that was bad. It's actually really, really important. Except it's dehumanizing. So controlled leadership's useful. We need efficiency. We need people to drive efficiency using the best science, using the best data, but we don't need it in a dehumanizing way. And the factory was a dehumanizing place. It got moved into the 1950s bureaucracy in the office. It became a dehumanizing office. Like, you knew your place. Everyone had a place and you just knew your place. Controlled leadership went in demise in the 1960s and therapist leadership took over. But just to say that controlled leadership is back on the rise big time.
Technology, surveillance, modernity.
Everything.
We're self-controlling through our phones on every aspect of our life.
Your phone will tell you when to stand up. If you've been sitting down for too long, you'll measure everything. It's like we live in a kind of a quantifiable world. We become quantifiable selves. Everything is measured and it's quite dangerous. If someone else isn't surveying us, we'll surveil ourselves. It's like a part of it. So controlled leadership is really, really back big time. The second wave of leadership we identified was post-Second World War in the West. There was a drive for democratizing the workplace. People were fearful of dictators. They were fearful of Stalin or Hitler. They were fearful of fascism or fearful of the Reds under the beds. So they decided, let's try and democratize the workplace. And they did this by kind of bringing in kind of people skills. And in the 1960s, the countercultural revolution, individualism took over, free love, free choice took over. And this kind of therapeutic culture came into the workplace. So you started to get kind of personnel departments. And the idea was that for the first time that you came to work on yourself. Whereas the first job I had in the factory was like you came to work to bring your body to work and you got paid at the end of the week. It wasn't about personal growth. Now work becomes about personal growth. You know, you come to work to kind of develop yourself. And Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the Tavistock Institute, they're all working to humanize the workplace. With this idea that it wasn't just altruistic, it was also about kind of a happy worker as a more productive worker. So the controller was about controlling people and getting the best at making them most efficient. The therapist was about motivating people. So you've got psychologists in the workplace, you've got psychometrics, you've got emotional intelligence. You've got this huge wave of kind of, and again, that's very kind of powerful today. It's very influential today. We see it in coaching, we see it in the emotional intelligence kind of market. So that's another sort of second wave, and that's still with us very strongly. In the 1980s, there was an economic collapse in the West. And there was a problem. And in America in particular, they looked over their shoulder and they saw that the Asian tiger economies were rising. And it was baffling to them. How could these small countries in the East, Singapore and places, be outperforming this giant America? You know, how could Toyota cars be beating kind of Ford cars? Mm. So they started asking questions about how that happened. And their research showed that that happened because of collective cultures. This is what they believe, that these Asian economies had collective cultures. You went to the car factory, you all dressed in the same uniform, you sang the company song, you raised the company flag, and they had quality circles. They asked workers what they thought could be improved. They engaged workers in a very different way. The whole thing was about a collective force working together to improve manufacturing. So in America, they looked at this and they realized they couldn't suddenly replicate an Asian collective culture, but what they could do, they thought, was create transformational leaders. So you suddenly got this body of work where transformational leadership was written about, and the word culture came into the organizational field for the first time, and you got people like Kundo writing about engineering culture. So you had leaders who could engineer cultures. And the idea was you get a charismatic leader like Steve Jobs, who'd have a vision, he'd sell the vision to kind of the Apple employees, and you didn't work there just for money, you worked there because you believed you were changing the world. You believed in the chief executive vision, and they got these very strong cultures.
And it worked.
And it partly worked.
We've all got an iPhone.
it partly works. Like it works up to a point, but then it becomes a bit like a cult. Mm-hmm. And this, some of the writings were unbelievable. That people were saying, some of the famous writers were saying, like, you know, a good company works like a cult. You know, a strong culture is what you need. The trouble with that is that it squashes dissent. You're not allowed to question the leader. If you question the leader, if you leave work before 7 o'clock at night, you've been there 12 hours, you're being disloyal. So you start getting this peer surveillance, this culture control, and it can silence dissent. And when you silence dissent, you get things happen like Enron, where you get massive collapses in organizations. So it works for a while, and then you kind of get problems because it becomes over-controlling. It doesn't allow freedom of thinking, and that means you don't get creativity, you don't get innovation, and you get kind of problems covered over. So you've got controller leadership, therapist leadership, then messiah leadership. This was what we called messiah leadership, and the chief executive wages went astronomical at this stage. They were getting messiah wages alongside being messiah leaders. And then the final wave is identified as eco-leadership. And this was a new wave, and it's still fairly new. I mean, I wrote about this in 2008, saying that the prefix eco has started to be seen arising. We lived in a network society. Castells calls this a network society. And it seemed to me that the first three phases, controller, therapist, messiah, are all quite familiar to us. We all know transformational leaders, the idea, charismatic leadership. We all know kind of therapist leaders, controller leaders. But eco-leadership is this kind of new way of thinking that we now live in a network society. The internet, the digital age, the environmental crisis means we can't escape our interdependence with nature. We have to pay attention to kind of these wider ecosystems. And yet there's a gap. There's no leadership to account. How do we do this? And this is where I've come in with my ideas of eco-leadership, developed a theory of eco-leadership based on practice, based on the work I've done in all these different organisations, around how leaders can lead differently from just a top-down approach to a much more collaborative approach, a much more kind of distributed approach, where leadership's throughout the whole organisation, not just at the top.
And the basics of that, it's a value-based kind of approach, isn't it? I mean, it celebrates the vibrancy of humanity and human connection, and I think this was the thing that really struck me, because at its heart, our work is about human connection and hope and that sort of vibrancy of togetherness and celebrating... Yeah. Those kind of ideas. I mean, do you want to just elaborate on the sort of maybe just the basics of, and this is the stuff that really connected me very quickly, the sort of four or five key principles.
So I mean, three kind of key practice principles of eco-leadership. The first is social purpose. So organisations were seeing themselves as if they were closed systems. They weren't part of wider environment, they were just there to make money. This is Milton's idea that companies should only make money, that's it, you know, without taking account for the wider system. So the first thing is to say, no, organisations belong to communities, global communities, they belong to the planet, they have to take consequences of environmental damage, and to belong you have to reconnect with social purpose. So what is your social purpose? And that's not just some messiah leader saying a nice vision statement, it's everybody in this team, everybody in the humanitarian sector, everybody in the bank saying, no, what are we about? What am I going to work for? Trying to reconnect with social purpose. So that's a fundamental kind of principle. You have to reconnect with whatever organisation you're in, and that's not too hard for humanitarians because they usually have that from the off, but sometimes they forget it. Mm. Sometimes they go off-piste and they forget what that social purpose is. So it's reminding people about their social purpose, and it's localising it, not making it just some big statement from the top. The second part of eco-leadership is the idea of participative organisations. So rather than thinking about an organization like a pyramid with a chief executive, a board, and then you just do what you're told further down the line, it's about how can we distribute leadership so that everybody can participate. Because our belief is that everybody has leadership potential. And leadership shows up not just in kind of five traits or five different competences, it shows up in very, very different ways. You get quiet leadership, you get charismatic leadership. The silent person in the room who's a bit shy, they can show great leadership. If we open a space for them to show it, you know, they can see it, they can observe everything, and if you stop the loudmouth talking and say kind of what do you think, you'll get something very special quite often. So we believe that everyone has leadership potential and that we should open up spaces so leadership can develop. Everybody can participate, everybody can become a leader at times, and we also believe that leadership's fluid, that it's not just a chief executive or someone in position power, that it actually kind of moves between people. So even if you're the president of the United States, you stand back and you let other people take the lead. At some stages you're a follower, some stages you're a team player, And leadership moves around people and it becomes collective at times. And when you get organizations which are more participative, people feel that they can take leadership, you have a much healthier organization, much more kind of successful organization, and that's what we're trying to do in the sector. And the third principle is developing eco-mindsets, and I think this is the most difficult piece. I think we're so conditioned by this modernity way of thinking that we still think in linear ways, we think about goals, we think about targets. To think about systemic connections, think about our interdependencies, is problematic. So we work very hard to do ecosystem mapping. We did some in South Africa recently. And it's really valuable because people start to see that in the wider ecosystem, there's resources, there's talent, there's knowledge, there's connections to be made. And it's about looking at the ecosystem to see how you can mobilize the ecosystem to deliver more successfully.
And you talk about eco-mutualism as well. Do you want to say a bit about the mutualist kind of mindset, which is kind of eco-leadership is the way to get there, but there's sort of a deeper philosophy, which is a very fundamental one in sort of the kind of solidarity that inspired a lot of humanitarian action, a lot of what we do. But this real, it's a different word for people are familiar with the concept, but it's kind of a different language for it. And you said that it'd be good to sort of just elaborate a bit on that, and also how it landed when you talked about it in sort of places like South Africa.
Yeah, so eco-mutualism is when I wrote this report on the sector, critical theory and critiquing things is quite easy. People often critique things. The challenge is where we go from there. And I came up with this term eco-mutualism, and it's really saying that these two words together, ecosystems and mutualistic ways of thinking of mutualism, are very powerful anchors. They can hold a direction of travel. Ecosystems are really to think about, we are interconnected to the environment, we are interconnected to technologies, we are interconnected with each other, and we have to learn how to manage that. It's about collaboration, it's about partnerships, it's about seeing patterns in ecosystems, it's about thinking more connectively. So that's fundamental in what we do. But the other part of it is we have to be more mutualistic. And mutualism is about asking a question at every meeting you go to. Who's at the table and who's not at the table? Who's speaking and who's being heard? Where in the ecosystem are we leaving people out? It's about creating shared value. It's not just about save the children or are great people because they give aid to others. We give the people at the edge some aid. It's about how mutually we can co-create humanitarianism. That's a different way of thinking than salvation aid, top-down aid. It's about how can we co-create this together? How can we see you as a mutual actor with mutual agency, with mutual energy? How can we think about what you bring to this as well as what we bring to this? And also to acknowledge what we get out of this.
And you were saying earlier that when you sort of elaborated that in Zimbabwe with a group of our staff, they latched onto this very quickly.
It's interesting because there's some questions about, is this language a bit difficult and should we change the language? You go to Zimbabwe and you go to Poland working with Ukrainian refugees, and the NGOs working on the edge are like, yeah, we get this. We work in ecosystems, of course, because we have to work with the government, we have to work with the local CSOs, we have to participate with the people, we have to get the farmers to kind of work with us. And they got it really, really quickly. And mutualism, we have to collaborate. It's the only way we can work is by through collaboration. This is great. Give us more of it.
So if it's sort of self-evident to people, and it sort of feels self-evident to me, listening, then the problem becomes about power for me and power in the system, and we're talking about shifting power in aid. And for me, that's a very radical idea, because shifting power, if you, from the perspective of a Western gaze inside the sector, we had a really interesting experience of this recently when we launched the Alameda Institute, and you were there, Simon.
Yeah, yeah.
200 very left-leaning political intellectuals on a very rainy Monday night in London, in the East End. But the room was full, and there was an energy attached to this. And for me, the moment where a penny dropped about how you, the problematic nature of sort of use of language unless you really explore it, is when William Shockey, for those who don't know, is a 24-year-old talent from South Africa who is a writer and has Africa as a country platform connected all over the place. Now, William hadn't been out of South Africa to London before. He left the country once, I believe, Ben, previously. William wasn't coming to London to sort of receive anything. He was coming to London to school us, you know, on what shifting the power means to a next generation South African in the post-ANC kind of, you know, liberation era. And the first word he used was the Hausa word for power, a mandla. And so my point here is that the gaze, how we talk about that as shifting power from a Western agency institutional position is one thing. But the radical nature of that language out in the ecosystem in the hands of a young South African, you know, influencer is very different. So is the issue power, and is the issue diffuse power in modern organizations? Why don't we all just buy into this instantly? And is it habit? What's the sort of psychoanalyst's view of this? What stops us just latching onto this and going with this in 5 minutes as self-evident?
Well, there's a number of factors. So one is power, for sure. The people, all of us actually have investments. We have attachments and investments, conscious and unconscious. So we're attached to our comfortable lives. We're attached to kind of being the good donors who like to give to others. You know, we have these narratives which have come through the kind of humanity sector for years. You know, so but, you know, that's difficult to challenge. You know. And then there's the unconscious, this is why I come back to the modern mindset. The unconscious stops us thinking about mutualism. People don't actually go to a room and say and think about, we've got mutual agency in this room. They don't ask that question. They might make assumptions about, I'd like to shift a bit of power from me to you, or I'd like, you know, perhaps we can give the local aid people 20% more. We can give 20% more, you know. It's this kind of language now. The mutualism is not there. Mutualism is kind of a radical egalitarianism. And it's not to pretend that there's going to be the same power. There's not. There's always going to be power differentials, locally as well as globally. So this idea that local good, central bad, I don't buy that either. You know, there's bad actors locally and there's bad actors centrally as well, you know. So even locally, you have to kind of, there's power differentials. You know, some people are good at getting money, some people not so good because they're different skill sets, you know. So you have to kind of work all the time, but being transparent about it and working in it and starting with the assumption that there's a mutualism here, that we're going to get shared value out of this. We're not going to just do it for our good or for your good. It's where's the shared value created for all the stakeholders here?
If there are questions arising, I'm just thinking to our audience who are listening and online. If you're online and you want to ask a question, by all means, just come off mute and we're in the room on the system, so we'll hear you. Good, great. We've got a question coming in. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, I was on mute. So you can call me Amr. Thank you so much, Dr. Simon. This is really impressive. My question to you is around, so we have been doing business as usual for a long time, and it seems that it has been only able to impact individuals. So how do you think that eco-leadership can lead to the systemic change, especially because the key stakeholders are still doing it like business as usual? And when I talk about key stakeholders, I'm mainly speaking about donors. So they are doing it the old way, and they have, unfortunately, the power, they have the money. So how can eco-leadership lead to this change?
Great question, Amir. Thank you. The way I study change has been through studying social movements. In social movements, in societies, change has always come from the edge. So we have a way of thinking leadership from the edge. We call it ledge. We have a ledge group. So what we think is that in ecosystems, we create changes at the edges. So people start creating small changes lead to bigger changes go viral. So we'll certainly work at the top. We'll chip away at the top all the time. We will run senior leadership courses. We'll kind of do our best to influence there. But what we really believe is that there'll be momentum driven from the edges, driven from the ecosystem. So we are hoping to plant seeds of change and work with others. And it's not us doing it. It's like ecosystem change comes from itself. We just have a bit of language. We're part of an ecosystem. We'll play a little part in this. But we think that kind of that's how change really takes place in society. And that's how we think change will drive it. So we'll drive it from the edge, lots of small changes, creating bigger changes until you get a final culture change, and the top will change too.
Where have you seen it work, Simon?
when I remember environmentalism in the 1980s, people talked about tree huggers and these people who were mocked, you know, they were laughed at, you know. And they've driven change throughout the system. So that, you know, the social movements kind of bring change in. The civil rights movements brought change in. You see it in almost, you know, women's voting. It's everywhere where change is taking place. And the humanitarian sector itself, you know, led from the edge initially. Like, you know, it was an edge-driven change which wanted to change slavery and change child labour and things. You know, so you see it everywhere. And companies are very interested in ecology now because they realise that it makes them more adaptive, it makes them more agile to change, even if they're not doing it from an altruistic position, taking up the ecosystemic way that they realise is very, very useful.
Are there any other questions? Anyone in the room want to ask a question or online? That was a great question. I mean, thanks very much. Go ahead, Juliana. You're in a cafe, by the sound of things, somewhere in Rio.
Yeah, I'm in a cafe, so I'm keeping my camera on. I apologise, and I hope you can hear me. Very, very interesting discussion, thanks to both of you, and particularly to Simon. Simon, the challenge to modern and modernist thinking is one that has been necessary in some sense for 50 odd years, right, and has been developed. Challenges to modernism have been developed for more than 50 years. A sense that the end of the modern project was inevitable. It's something that could be seen in popular culture, in theory, in different forms of scholarship from the 1960s at least onwards. And yet that raises a question, strategic question about change, because there was a premise on which modernist ideas, whether they were of the left or of the right, that progress itself was a motor of change, would bring about change through mechanism, that would be almost a process that didn't require individuals and their subjective judgments. And yet, certainly looking more than the sort of the left progressivist ideas that presume that this process of progress would lead to a society that was freer, or with freer individuals, that was ultimately without classes, and that was fairer, more equal, comes up against a problem in which, if that mechanism doesn't bring about the change on its own, you require some action of individuals. And here, I suppose, is where the conjunction of psychoanalytic and philosophical ideas has played a significant role in challenging modernist schemes. But it doesn't necessarily provide us with the resolution, doesn't provide us with the plan itself. And the tendency has often been then to revert to ideas or to proposals for just simply reimagining. And reimagining is a very easy exercise. It's quite a self-indulgent exercise when it's not connected to real processes of social transformation, that is, when it's not connected to the daily experience of people, connected to their social economic status and positioning within society. And so my question is, you spoke about in this conversation, in your work, you address questions of equal leadership and mutualism, and there is a sense built within that work that there's a need to exercise imagination. But how can this work that you're proposing be connected to other activities that actually are contributing to the creation of social conditions, concrete conditions that might themselves support the production of a new imagination? Which is probably a question that I can't answer.
Yeah. What's the question, Julian?
but maybe you can point us in the direction of the response.
Yeah. Thanks, Juliana. That's you and I should get in a room and have a long discussion for sure. I think the problem with the left is still entrapped in this modernist ideology, and even though it seemed to have failed, I still think it thinks in that way. I draw a lot on Donna Haraway and writers like this, where you have to think, you have to build emergence into the picture. So if you develop around eco-leadership, develop around kind of eco-mutualism, there's an emergence there, and it's going to look different in different parts of Africa to Poland. It's going to look different in Brazil to kind of in London. But there's kind of an emancipatory thread there. You know, it's something about hanging on to the emancipatory ideology of the left whilst also being very pragmatic. And I think social movements can teach us quite a lot about pragmatism and how to achieve things. But I think it's a longer discussion. But thanks very much for the question, Giuliano. We come back to it.
Cheers, Matt. Yeah, let's do that.
Thanks.
Any other questions? We've got a couple of minutes left. I mean, on a practical level, Simon, I've been through your coaching course. How do you see that landing? Bringing that in, you know, we're going to run various versions of that, aren't we, around the world?
Yeah.
Do you want to just say a little bit about how you see that playing out from here for people?
I think that's important. Yeah. So I am a very practical person. I kind of I'm a gardener and I'm a nurse. You know. So I write books as well, but really I'm a gardener and a nurse, and I make bread and stuff. You know, that's kind of what I do. And the course is follows my own author a bit. So we go through the course in five stages. So it's about depth analysis, relational analysis, leadership analysis, ecosystem analysis, and then strategic analysis. And that takes you on a journey, as Gareth knows. So you go deep into yourself. It's like do your soul work, find your purpose, ask some questions about your own resistances, do some deep work on yourself first, and then think about your relationships. How do you relate to others? How do they relate to you? How do you work in teams? What patterns have you got which you keep bumping into? What's your symptom, Gareth, as we...
Messiah, I think you get diagnosed, Simon, is that recall?
And then we think about leadership, how you kind of how you take up leadership in your own personal way. So you think about your inner self, to your relational self, to your leadership self, and then about how do you influence networks, how do they influence you, how can you make a difference in the ecosystem, and then you develop some strategies. So you go on this journey. I think that's going to work well here, and it'll be taken up differently in different cultures and different places, but I think the journey is quite familiar to people.
Yeah, and I think that was my experience. I mean, I did the course over 12 weeks, very intense. It was running at 4 o'clock in the afternoon to 8 p.m. I'm a morning person. I was already worried about the idea how that play out. And it was a very different group of people as well. It wasn't humanitarians. It was many of them were spread all over the world. Many came from a sort of psychotherapy background, which was fascinating. It was very, very illuminating. And I think what I experienced from that was a lot stays with you, and a lot and in a sort of settling way. And it's this idea of, if we feel stuck in our, where I think the ecosystemic language helps is you find new ways, you know, it takes you on different paths. And when we try the same thing the whole time, inevitably we're going to get the same answer, and especially in a sort of mechanistic, machine-like, sort of institutional kind of way. So it's that, there's a liberating sort of feeling to it. And I guess my encouragement to everybody is to get curious, and to get curious about what that might look like for them as individuals, and what it might look like in their shared collaborative spaces as we sort of go on a bit of an experiment. You know, I think it's not so much the methodologies that are experimental, it's a new environment in which to try these things. And we want to sort of have a kind of action learning approach to this and sort of harvest a lot of learning as we go. And it'll be fascinating to see, I'm looking at Pavel now, how this plays through in Poland. It'll be fascinating to see how this plays through at different parts of the world. But there is something, my intuition is that there's something very powerful here that if we pursue it with a degree of sort of open-heartedness and curiosity, we'll move something, we'll create some movement in the movement, which is much needed, I think.
I hope so, and I'm excited to do more work with you all.